Welcome to the Regen Brands Podcast. This is a place for consumers, operators, and investors to learn about the consumer brands supporting regenerative agriculture and how they're changing the world. This is your host, Kyle, joined with my co-host, Dave C. Let's dive in.
On this episode, we have Carol and Ken, who are the co-founders and co-CEOs at Lotus Foods. Lotus Foods is supporting regenerative agriculture through their organic rice products. In this episode, we learn about Lotus Foods' origin story, their mission to keep the biodiversity of rice alive, and how they're partnering with smallholder farmers across the globe to produce rice using the system of rice intensification. Now, I know the system of rice intensification doesn't sound super regenerative in name, but it definitely is. Carol and Ken are a wealth of knowledge in this space, and we learned a ton about the rice industry and what it will take to transition that crop to regen overall. Let's go. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Regen Brands Podcast. We are very excited today to have Carol and Ken from Lotus Foods. We are going to be talking regen rice and many, many other topics. So welcome, y'all. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Kicking it off on a Monday morning, you know, nothing better than talking regen.
And rice, right?
So for those who are not familiar with Lotus Foods, just give us kind of like a general overview of like your company, where you can be found today, what sort of products you have and things like that.
So we're a specialty organic rice company that started in 1995, so over 26 years ago. So we've been around a long time. So we actually began with the idea of keeping the biodiversity of rice alive by partnering with smallholder farmers who were growing rice more sustainably and giving them access to a global marketplace at a fair trade price. And so it kind of morphed through the years from conventional rice to organic rice as we got educated ourselves on the dysfunction of rice farming. You know, we knew that we could actually be innovators and do something of tremendous value. And so in 2005, when Cornell University, the Center for International Food and Agricultural Development at Cornell, came to Lotus Foods and said, hey, guys, do you know about the system of rice intensification, a much more agroecological way to grow rice that gave farmers double and triple their yields with less inputs, less water, less seed, no agrochemicals, less methane gas emissions. We said, oh my goodness, and traveled to Madagascar and Indonesia and Cambodia, where these SRI farmers were coming out of deficit and farming at a deficit. So they had capacity to actually create markets, and we have never looked back. So I'll let Ken continue, but, you know, about the brand and some of our products.
Well, just a bit of context on what Carol touched upon in terms of working with smallholder farmers. So they really are what it sounds like. They have small plots of land, and a lot of time they're living on the fringe. And so what she was talking about in terms of deficits, meaning they have small plots of land, so they can't grow enough rice to feed themselves. So imagine being a rice farmer and not having enough rice to feed your family. And so the empowerment of this new method of growing rice is what really allowed farmers to actually challenge being able to supply a company like Lotus Foods, because they had enough where they could grow enough for themselves, maybe even some for the local marketplace, which further raises livelihood. And then, of course, aggregating in whether it's cooperatives or any kind of entity, we're agnostic in terms of that. We're just really trying to, as Carol mentioned before, preserve the biodiversity of rice and connect these farmers who are doing the good work to our existing distribution channel. So you can find us, you know, in the beginning, we were largely and still are largely a natural foods company. So you would find us in places like Whole Foods and cooperative stores around the country. But now we've expanded into even the club channel, like Costco type of stores, as well as what they call MULO, which is the mass market stores, which is mainly where people shop in America. So I think a lot of times we get caught up on a coastal kind of activity, you know, with markets. But, you know, if we're going to really reach a wider breadth of consumers, and customers really need to expand into these kind of mass market channels as well, in order to actually provide consumers with healthier choices that are regenerative in nature, that sequester carbon, that kind of address some of these major issues that we're confronted with, you know, whether it's how much water we're using, what kind of CO2 emissions. I think a lot of times, if you really look at the overall situation with climate, a lot of it's due to how we grow food and the dysfunction there.
Totally.
So, yeah.
So I just want to add, again, to what Ken was saying. So we became innovators in that we were the first people to bring pigmented rices to this marketplace, to the U.S. Mm. So we're talking about a black rice from China that we discovered on our first market research trip in 1993 through China. And that's where we discovered the black rice that we marketed and trademarked as forbidden rice. And it's still our most popular rice today. And then for the red rice, which is the other whole grain pigmented rice, we started in the Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan and imported this amazing red rice from Bhutan that actually cooked up like a white rice in 20 minutes. And yet it was roasted. It was earthy and nutty and just really fantastic. But now our red rice is a jasmine rice from Thailand that is grown using some of these SRI methodologies. So we've always tried to be very innovative in our product line. We brought in the first rice ramen, which is really one of our most popular products, and that morphed into rice noodles, whether it be pad Thai rice noodle or an organic brown rice udon or a soba noodle with brown rice and buckwheat.
So while we're on that topic, let's just walk through the portfolio as it stands today. How many different rice varieties are there? How many noodle varieties are there? And what other sort of like line extensions or categories is Lotus playing in right now?
Well, it's interesting. Carol mentioned the pigmented varieties in that we were looking for a way to differentiate ourselves, because when you look to enter a marketplace, it's quite mature, regardless of what category you're in stores, right? And so that's the red rice and the black rice certainly did that. At the same time, you know, we didn't go into right away things like jasmine and basmati rice, which are, of course, wonderful specialty rice varieties that are aromatic. So they have that wonderful like flower, floral-like aroma of jasmine rice, or like that kind of a popcorn kind of aroma of basmati rice, because a lot of people were already playing in that category. But what happened was when we were introduced to the system of rice intensification, we also all of a sudden said, oh, that's the differentiator. It's not good enough to grow rice without chemicals, you know, because that's what we started with, conventional growing methods, you know, and then said, oh, let's do it organic because, you know, all the chemical usage. But then we saw that there's all these other issues that we need to get behind. And so we realized it's not good enough to grow rice without chemicals. Somehow it needs to be doing more, like organic plus, if you will, or now what's been coined, the term is now regenerative. But I think that's a better thing than sustainable, staying the same, regeneration, so that, you know, we can do all these things in terms of building soil, sequester carbon and things like that. And so it's been kind of a, like most journeys, I guess, it's a meandering pathway. And so this is where we are at this point in time. And I think you mentioned earlier 2050, but I think there's much more urgency around making this thing go a little faster, because it is an existential crisis, right, that is before us at this time.
But going back to the product, so as far as the rice is concerned, what Ken was talking about with the basmati, so most consumers don't know that most of the basmati in this country are hybrids. Basmati is not an easy rice to grow in India. It takes a lot of water, takes a lot of labor. And so most of the rice that was bred in India now for the global market is not a true basmati. So again, being the innovators, we knew when we were going to bring a basmati, it was going to be a landrace heirloom varietal. And so we have the mother of all basmatis, and it's just an amazing. And the consumer should really just take the taste test and actually see for themselves how incredible it is. And on top of being an heirloom land race rice, meaning land race means that it has never been changed. It just is passed down from generation to generation. Along with that, now it's being grown using SRI agroecological methodology. So we really feel like we have done as much as we can to bring, you know, regenerative rice to the consumer. And the same with jasmine. Our jasmine rice was the very first organic jasmine rice that was actually grown in Texas by the Lowell family. And this is we're talking about 20 years ago.
Love it.
But that was really great. And now we are importing a homily rice, which is just one of the best rices out of Thailand, true jasmine rice as well. We've got the red rice that I mentioned before, that's now coming from Thailand. And also we have something called jade pearl. So this is a very unique rice. So it's a short grain rice. It's kind of like a sushi rice that we infuse with bamboo leaf extract. So bamboo leaf extract gives it really intense vanilla grassy flavor, but it also has health giving properties. It's antibacterial. It's all filled with that green, the wonderful green chlorophyll. So it's really healthy as well. It's just, you have to remember not to rinse this rice because you'll wash out all that beautiful chlorophyll.
We have a funny story. We were doing a trade show once and we said, let's use that jade pearl rice and make like sushi rolls where the outer rice is a green color instead of white rice. And so I brought it to a sushi restaurant where I knew the chef, and I didn't give any instructions. And I didn't realize, of course, I should have realized that the Japanese, the technique of cooking rice, first they rinse it like incessantly until it runs, until the water runs clear. Well, what they did was what Carol said not to do, was to rinse all that chlorophyll out. And so when we picked up the rolls, they were all white looking. And I was like, did you use our rice?
Yeah. Right.
So, but I also want to also thank Carol for getting us back on track, because I was explaining about products and then went off into a tangent. But so thanks for reeling me back in, Carol. And then
that's what I do, right?
We do it for each other. So the other thing that one of the variety, our newest rice release, is an ancient variety called Kali Jeera. Comes from India as well. It's also known as Govinda Bagh. We've kind of titled it Quick Cook because this is a tiny, tiny rice. It's like the size of two or three sesame seeds. And it's wonderfully aromatic. And so it's kind of like a baby basmati-ish kind of rice. But this is something that we had in the past added to our line. And then we had to stop it because there was a perceived shortage of rice in Bangladesh where we were getting it. And so many years passed by, and then we were at the largest organic trade show in the world in Nuremberg, Germany. And we came across this gentleman who had it in his stall. And we recognized it immediately because it's so distinctive. And it turns out he's like the forerunner in India for organic and fair trade. He even was into biodynamic. He was doing SRI, which we market as more crop per drop, which is this way of growing rice that uses less to produce more, less water, less seed, no chemicals, and farmers can get bigger yields, less labor for women, as well as mitigating methane emissions, which is like 20 times more noxious greenhouse gas than even CO2, which many people are rightly fixated
on. So this quick cook rice cooks in only 10 minutes.
That's
pretty amazing. And it's
speaking my language.
It's our newest rice and really, really delicious. And then the one, of course, that we can't forget is the forbidden rice, which is the black rice. And then from the forbidden rice, I mean, so imagine back in 1993, when we took this market research trip through China, we were in the southwesternmost part of China called Sichuan Bana. And there's 26 different minority villages. And we were staying in a Dai minority village and sat down to steaming bowls of black rice. So here you're in the middle of China, or not in the middle of China, you're in the southwest corner of China, and you're eating black rice, which, you know, Ken grew up in a Chinese household and you only ate white rice. And it had this roasted nutty flavor with almost a hint of fruit or floral at the finish. It was just absolutely delicious and so exotic looking. So we kept on going to markets, which was our favorite thing to do anyway, and asking people, tell us about Hami. Hey me means black rice. Me is rice. Hey is black. And everybody told us the same folktale, that this was, because of its nutritional and medicinal value, it was exclusively reserved for the emperors to ensure their good health and long life. And we actually, and that's why we named it Forbidden Rice, the emperor's exclusive grain, when we're walking around the Forbidden City, you know, 2 months later, and Ken says, I have a great idea, which was a brilliant idea. But we actually got to meet the king of black foods. So black foods like blueberries and acai and other black foods. In Chinese medicinal medicine, they say it's a blood tonifier. It aids in the circulation of the blood. It's high in qi. It invigorates the spleen. It brightens the eyes. So it's just this superfood.
I'm in for all that, Carol.
Tastes great, too. But it also has to taste great.
Yeah, so if you had like iron poor blood, or maybe you lost blood in an accident or menstrual cycle or things like that, you could eat this kind of food to restore the balance in the blood. And this kind of like, I think it's a thing in a lot of ancient cultures, is they know the function of food. It's not just like, what does it taste like? So it's very interesting that way.
Couple comments that come to mind, and then one question, and we'll there's so much there to unpack. So we'll dive into a couple of those things in more depth. One, you know, being a foodie, you know, myself, like I still just think of brown rice and white rice. So it's just crazy that's the culture that we have today. So we can talk more about that later as well. And then the other comment is rice intensification. We might have to rebrand that, because that sounds a little conventional industrial agriculture to me. And I think you guys are working on that for your internal stuff. So I love that. But I want to hone in on this trip to China, right? You're calling it market research. Was it like a trip that you now, you know, retroactively call market research? Did you really want to start a rice company? And then just give us the whole arc of why'd you go? You kind of told us what happened and how it was the inspiration behind Lotus.
We wanted to start a company. We had no idea it was going to be rice. We knew after Tiananmen Square, rice, I mean, China was opening up. It was changing. We knew it was going to be an economic force. And so we decided to, you know, the first idea was to maybe just go around the world looking for opportunities. But that was just...
Adventure spirit.
But it was so daunting. And here Ken coming from, you know, a Chinese American family, and with what was going on in China, we thought of having a focus would be so much better. And it was. Yeah. So we planned this trip.
So you picked the small geographical area.
Exactly. And we came home with 90 ideas, and we still have the piece of paper that lists all these 90 ideas. And, but it was where very early on in the trip where we found the black rice, and where we kept on coming across it in marketplaces and talking to more people. And we shipped home a couple of kilos of it. And as soon as we got back, we said, okay, it's going to be rice. And
where we got back to was the Bay Area in California. Yeah. So Carol and I met in Connecticut, and we had this great idea to start a Pacific Rim business. But then the idea hit us that, well, maybe we should move to the Pacific Rim. So hard to start a Pacific Rim business in Connecticut. Now it seems natural with everyone working remotely, but back then it was a little bit strange. So when Carol says, when we got back and we assessed these 90 ideas, you know, living in arguably one of our country's food meccas, you know, San Francisco Bay Area, it seemed like a natural that, you know, and so much innovation, right, comes from the West or from California. And we thought this would be something that, you know, would be difficult. This would differentiate ourselves. Like, who else has black rice and red rice? Not many people, but then nobody knows what these things are. So that was the challenge, right? How do we educate folks to kind of build up the demand so that we could actually become a viable company? So that was a big challenge, but it was also a great
opportunity. So the way we did it is we sent it to the top San Francisco chefs.
Yes.
And they all loved it because what chef wouldn't want a new palate for the center of their plate? So we really feel
just so beautiful, so visually appealing, and such a stark difference from the general take. Like Anthony mentioned earlier, just white or brown. So yeah, I could see those top chefs getting really excited.
But the thing, because I would approach these chefs and they would look at the samples, and it was that they could picture that big white plate that they serve at their restaurant, and they said, "This will look stunning." But Ken, if this looks great but doesn't taste good, you've made one sale. And then you're done. So luckily, it was also very tasty. And I think this at the time, you know, natural foods, everything was all about nutrition. Specialty food was all about taste great. And I think the public was hungering for something that tastes great and good for you. So nutritious and delicious. And I think this is the kind of thing that we stepped into in terms of the market was ready. And then later, when we became a noodle company, you know, we started innovating with added value products. Carol mentioned all these other kinds of noodles that we've introduced. This really, being in the noodles kind of like it made it even more accessible to many more people. And so
that because what Ken is trying to say also is, ramen is everybody's beloved, whether you're a kid or your college student. Everybody remembers, and they still have, you know, the dollar or $2 ramen cake that you can eat on a limited budget. But all ramen at the time was made from wheat, and there's a tremendous gluten sensitivity in this country and worldwide. And so being able to make a rice ramen that looked like a wheat ramen, but also tasted great, that had great texture, all of a sudden, it was just explosive how the ramen took off, because not only were we making a ramen that gluten intolerant people could eat, we were making a black rice ramen. We were making a millet and brown rice ramen, so you had more protein. We weren't even making a white rice ramen. So we were, again, innovating. We made a jade pearl ramen with the bamboo extract as well. So again, you know, continuing that line of innovation.
So I just want to say that I'm fasting right now. And man, this conversation, like, I am so hungry. Hearing about all the promises, it's incredible. But I do want to dive in a little bit and talk about, you mentioned the one crop per drop. We've mentioned SRI. As briefly as you can, you know, as simple as possible, I'm sure, because you can probably get really into the weeds on this stuff. But like, talk about conventional rice production versus the one crop per, sorry, one drop
more per crop. More crop per drop.
You guys say more crop per drop. More crop per drop. And I just wanted to get back to, because Anthony brought up the point about the name, and Carol doesn't like the name either, System of Rice Intensification. But really, the reason it's a great name is because, go back to the premise we introduced, smallholder farmers, holdings of land. How can we improve yields so that they have enough food and maybe can sell some in the marketplace, or just grow less rice and grow other vegetables, which adds to their own diets, or they can sell those in the marketplace and further raise livelihood. So the idea of a system of rice intensification is that farmers can use, it becomes a less is more paradigm. And that's where the intensification comes in, is making the best use of the little bit of land that they have, which is so important, because that's another problem with smallholder farmers who, over the years, you know, they keep dividing that land amongst family members, and it just keeps getting smaller. And so we really need to have a way for farmers to improve their yields and have some way to actually progress beyond what they've been doing. It's interesting when you look at photos of farmers, if there were photos hundreds of years ago, they'd be the same as what they look like now. So despite all these attempts by aid agencies to improve yield, all they're doing is bringing synthetic chemicals, fertilizers, inputs like that, or special seeds that are proprietary to big companies that you have to keep buying, and they have to use chemicals to grow them. And it's like, it's a problem, because it's putting farmers in debt as opposed to helping them. And so my rant is about, you know, really helping farmers to actually improve livelihood. And actually, you know, people may think that like it's big ag that produces all the food, but no, it's smallholders that produce most of the food on the planet. Mm-hmm. And more people derive their livelihood from growing rice than anything else that human beings do on planet Earth. And so,
wow. Say that again, Ken. Say that again.
Yeah. The thing that people are most doing for work is related to rice. And when you think about it, the sheer amount of water, you know, when we introduce a phrase like more crop per drop, it's very well thought out, because rice uses more water than the number two and number three crops combined. So a quarter to a third of Earth's fresh water reserves is used to grow the rice crop every year on planet Earth. Could we use that water for other things like drinking or bathing, or just letting it go back into the ground so that it recharges aquifers, which are sensitive ecosystems, right? So, you know, you're right. This conversation actually spills out over and over into many, many benefits that accrue to people.
I want to touch on one thing real quick. I looked up some stats right before this call, and I think it's, as of a 2020 study that I saw on Statista, it's 164 million hectares of land is used globally to grow rice. And to put that in perspective, it's 164 million. The United States is 174 million. So almost the same amount of land as the entire United States of America is used to grow rice. So to your point, if we are starting to implement these methods that use 50% less water on that much land, like the potential positive ecological outcomes are just extraordinary.
Yeah. And that's exactly what we're doing.
I'm sure we're going to get into what is SRI, but
get into it right now, Ken. Jump in.
So traditionally, farmers grow rice in flooded rice fields, and so I think when we look at how things have been done for a millennia, we think that there's certain wisdom contained but rice is not an aquatic plant. It doesn't need to be flooded in fields. The reason they do it is, I think sometimes they just can't control it. It's just falling out of the sky. You know, there's monsoon seasons. There's all kinds of things like that. But the one real good benefit of flooded rice fields is it acts to prevent weeds from competing with the rice. So what happens is they have a nursery, and then they transplant those seeds into the production field. The field is flooded. So the seedlings are, you know, 35, 40, 45 days old. They may be like this tall. Like it looks like a real big, like green onion scallion that you'd buy in a supermarket. And they take four, five, six of them, and they bunch them together, one big clump, and they put it into a hill. And they take another clump and they put it. And so it's very densely populated throughout the field.
This is just to clarify, he is explaining conventional rice farming, not more crop per drop.
By having it planted like that, it looks very solid and like we're going to have a lot of food. But if anybody listening to this, what I'm saying now, is a gardener, you know, you don't crowd your seedlings, you thin them out, right? Why? So there's no less competition for nutrients, that type of thing, more photosynthesis. And so what they do in SRI is they take a single seedling that's very young, 8 to 15 days old. It's just like young children have more ability to like learn multiple languages all at once, right? So the young seedlings have an ability to sprout out more of the tillers and panicles, the trunk and the arms of the plant, which have more rice on them. And so they take a single seedling, one seedling, not four, five, or six, plant it by itself, space it out maybe 12, 15, 20 inches, depends on the variety, depends on the climate. Farmers need to experiment. And then you grow them in rows. Why? So that if you're not having flooded fields, those weeds will try to compete with the rice. So by having them in rows, they take this little, looks like a push hand mower. It's got handlebars, and the person is standing upright, which is big because if you look at how rice farming is done, it's backbreaking, bent over work. And the net effect of that is you see, like in villages, elderly women who can't stand up straight anymore because they've been hunched over. So anyways, they got them in rows. They can do upright work, weed the weeds back into the ground, forms more biomass for the plant to eat. But more importantly, provides oxygen flow into the soil, which provides more growth for more promotion of soil biota. So healthier soil by having by having the by not having the water table right there in a flooded field, the roots of the plants need to dive down deeper into the soil to access more like micronutrients. And mm-hmm. also it forms a larger root ball so that, you know, after 90, 120, 150, however many days it takes, you know, because it's photosynthetic derived, mm-hmm. When the winds blow, like the monsoon winds will come towards to harvest, if the foundation of the plant is not deep, it'll knock over, and that's called right. lodging. And the lodging, actually, you could lose most of your harvest. So mm-hmm. this is a really commonsensical thing. It's a single seedling planted in rows with plenty of spacing so you can do the weeding. And then as long as there's water coming on and off, then it conforms to this way to mitigate methane. Now, the difficult part in why some farmers don't trust this is because they don't have irrigation fields sometimes. They don't mm-hmm. control water. They only rely on what falls out of the sky. And if yeah. they let it run off, when's the next water coming? Mm-hmm. We don't know. So, mm-hmm. so then, but there's solutions to this. As you know, if more people can fund these things, there can be rainwater catchment systems. There could be
ponds.
Use of ponds. Mm-hmm. We have aquaculture, and you bring the water on as you need it and bring it back off. So that's a kind of a snapshot in terms of SRI. And the most powerful thing is seeing is believing. If you look at where farmers have, because they're skeptical, right? When you hear, oh, you want me to do this, it's like, but when they see what happens, when they get more yield with less, yeah. Yeah. Then they start to believe. And then it's like farmer to farmer kind of persuasion. They tell each other. And this is what we're really trying to do as a company, is create this kind of momentum so that farmers become empowered and they can actually take control of their lives. And what's happened is women gain a prestige position in the community because they've innovated. Now they've going on to more entrepreneurial things, or yeah. they're just becoming leaders. And, and so this is a great thing, whether you're looking at it through a Jedi lens, like, you know, equity, yeah. you know, that people can participate equally. So there's many, many positive benefits to the work, but it's so young yet. And so that's why I really appreciate having the opportunity to talk about it. Hopefully we're being clear about what we're talking.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, absolutely. All the regen growing terminology and practices conversations are so different based off geography, based off crop. So we've always really enjoyed, and it is nuanced. It's hard to encapsulate in just a 10-minute segment of like the 60-minute podcast, right? But it's making sense to me. And you talk about economics, you talk about the Jedi topics. Talk a little bit. You talked about the water, right? But carbon sequestration and soil health, I mean, we can kind of deduce some things from that, but let's just talk about regenerative, right? So when did that word like come on y'all's radar, and specifically with SRI, like what really makes it regenerative? So other than no chemicals, but maybe highlight a couple of those pieces and tell us like the regen specific journey part of it.
So about 4 years ago, when Rodale Press and Rodale and Dr. Brana's mm-hmm. and Patagonia decided that we had to go beyond organic mm-hmm. and they were creating the standards with the Regenerative Organic Alliance. Mm-hmm. They invited mm-hmm. Lotus Foods to be a pilot in yeah. the pilot program. There was about, started off a little bit more than 20, I think only 17 went actually through the program. And at the time, you know, we were a little bit skeptical only because who needed another bug on their on their retail package? And, right. you know, we already went through right. the fiasco of the Non-GMO verification yeah. project. Yeah. And so, you know, that was a little bit, that took us a little, you know, that was concerning to us. But
get them up to it.
But then, well, I think for us, the two main reasons why we thought we definitely needed to do this is we needed to be the voice of the smallholder farmer, the global smallholder awesome. Farmer, because what happens in India and Cambodia and Indonesia is very, very different from smallholders in the U.S. So that yes. was one of the primary reasons, because $100 soil test might not seem like a lot of money here in the U.S., but it's a tremendous amount of money, you know, in these developing countries. Mm-hmm. And then also we wanted to use this as an opportunity to really show the consumer and the retailer and the distributors that SRI, more crop per drop, was indeed regenerative. You know, from the get-go, which it is, and it was. So having this third-party certification gave us that that kind of assurance that we needed as well. Mm-hmm. So we're delighted right. that we did it, and we will continue to, you know, to certify these because it's so important. Mm-hmm. And we believe in it so much. I think the one thing, with, you know, with regenerative and the soils, you know, the more, the one thing Ken didn't say, also SRI, you can actually, it doesn't have to be organic. SRI is happening in over 60 countries with millions of farmers, but Lotus Foods and what we do with our particular farmers is strictly organic. So there's no chemicals or pesticides or herbicides. And so all the organic matter that's going back into the soil is, you know, is so important. And that's part of the whole regenerative movement as well, as creating better soils, because what you put into the soil is actually what you're going to put into that rice kernel. And so the more micro nutrients that are in the soil, the healthier that rice grain is going to be as well. So we're really excited to be a part of this movement.
That's awesome.
Carol, Carol mentioned, she just mentioned that, you know, our SRI is organic, but the way it's taught is quite agnostic and doesn't allows farmers, if they've got some circumstance with pests or something like that, they can add some pesticides. So,
but not for our brand. This is again, not for our brand.
But just for SRI, the way it's taught, and it's not a technology. So this is not owned by anyone. This is totally open source, and it's really the way it's taught is very respectful. It's understanding that the farmer knows a lot about their land, and that they should be brought along that way in a very respectful way. And so it's not like we're coming to save you. It's just like, here's something that works. And, and farmers are skeptical because, you know, you're asking them to put everything on the line, you know, in terms of feeding their family. Right. And so what really works is all those ag development agencies that are out there, like Oxfam or AfriCare or Catholic Relief Services or World Wildlife Fund. There's many organizations out there, and what they do brilliantly is they have built relationships. They have test plots. They invite the farmers to their test plot to see what they're doing, and they could see step by step what they're doing that's different. And then they can see over a month or 2 months or 3 months how things are improving. And then it's like, oh, it's not so risky. And then maybe they'll try a portion of their land. They'll do a test, not all of it, and prove it to themselves. And that's where I meant earlier when I was talking about farmer to farmer. And I think this is really what has empowered so many farmers and why it's in 60 nations right now. It's because of the empowerment factor that they've actually seen the results, and they want to continue that way. And if we can do this, we can kind of flip the switch in terms of, you know, how, what I mentioned before, how much water is used. Well, all those flooded fields, they account for about 15% of man-made methane emissions. So if we can, if we can bring on this change by voting with our wallets, by asking how is food produced, you know, knowing your farmer, all these things.
Ken, why does a flooded rice field produce methane, for those that don't know?
So the flooded rice field, it's anaerobic, meaning nothing can breathe. Soil can't breathe. The root systems can't breathe. It creates the conditions for methane emissions. Yeah, so basically there's a lot of rotting. Just like in landfills with all the wasted food. Like I'm sure all your listeners kind of know that about 40% of all food is wasted. And so there's another area where we can do better in terms of not creating all this greenhouse gases. So, it's certain microbes that are formed in those circumstances that are methane producing. And of course, methane is a short-lived greenhouse gas. And what does it turn into? CO2.
Yeah.
For another 100 years. So, we got a lot of work to do. But I think if people knew that they could actually do something. And I think that's the other question. People need to ask some questions so that, because there's many entry points to get involved. It doesn't have to be a rice solution. There's many, many ways in which we can be part of this global movement to kind of make things better for, you know, future generations.
Mm-hmm. So just to summarize and make it really simple, this methodology, 90% less seeds, 25 to 50% less water, 40% less methane emissions when fields are not continuously flooded.
Wow.
That's actually, and this is, and just by following those six different methods, younger mm-hmm. seedlings, more spacing, mm-hmm. water on and off, weeding intermittently in rows, planting in rows, watering on and off like you would a vegetable garden, mm-hmm. and you get double or triple the yields with less seeds, less water, less methane.
It's incredible. And it's super empowering when you lay it out in those really simple bullet point terms, as far as like what sort of an impact that can make for the farmer. Like they're buying less, they're using less, they're getting more, like they get to, like mm-hmm. you mentioned, get out of the deficit. That's incredibly powerful. I'm curious, you know, we touched a little bit on certifications and the number, well, what I assume is like a vast number of smallholder farmers that you all support.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking that probably creates a bit of a wrench into the certification system, because there's that many people that have to get certified. So tell us a little bit about what that looks like. And I believe there's two ROC certified SKUs in the Lotus portfolio mm-hmm. right now. And are there more coming? Like, what is that going to look like?
There are two right now, the white and the brown basmati rice that's grown mm-hmm. in Uttar Pradesh. And there's about, how many, you know, actually it's interesting. How many farmers, Ken?
There's about a few hundred, but then also mm-hmm. the farmers who are farming the quick cook, the Kali Jeera rice, that's about another 365 farmers. Wow. So these are small numbers, right? So just to give people a sense, you know, it's a really nascent kind of a movement. But if a farmer sees that, that's really the next one I want to bring up is, you know, we're talking about certification to bring validity to some of the things, because there's auditors that go out to the field. But what I would really hope can happen is when we talk about like less methane, if we could have on-field monitoring, whether it's through handheld device, whether it's through drones, whether it's satellite imagery, I don't care what it is. If we can validate it so that we can prove that these farmers are doing the good work.
Yes.
Right now, there's like this whole movement of carbon credits. That's basically mm-hmm. paying for your pollution, right? Mm-hmm. Why don't we reward those farmers doing the good work and in an in-setting methodology and mm-hmm. then reward them for what they're doing? And if we can monetize it by monitoring and validating what good they're doing, like how much water is saved, how much labor mm-hmm. is saved, you know, because let's face it, when we talk about how much labor is saved, we're talking about people who work in the field outside in extreme mm-hmm. weather conditions. Mm-hmm. And so the great thing that we've heard these stories from farmers is I don't have to work in the midday sun. I can go out early in the morning and later in the afternoon and then do other things like child rearing mm-hmm. or fetching water or all the things that farmers have to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we can actually create some kind of a monetization or reward system for farmers, guess what? Next door neighbor of them, that farmer is going to want to do the same thing, and their neighbor. And that'll really ramp up the adaptation of this method, because let's face it, farmers are no different than you and me and everyone else listening. They want to take care of their food, clothing, and shelter needs for their family so that their kids can have a better life. It's the same. It's a universal thing. Mm-hmm. So we can bring that kind of force to bear. I think that'll get us on the way. And I think people wield that kind of power if they realize it.
Mm-hmm. When you say that, I think to you all mentioning Cornell earlier, and right, so like when we talk about SRI, we talked about Cornell, we've talked about NGOs and nonprofits in these geographies, we've talked about private, you know, market actors that create markets like Lotus Foods, and there's probably others. And so this whole thing, I continue to be, you know, very bullish on the future, or very excited about, even though it is small now, we have a lot of bridges being built across these different organizations that we have to continue to do that to produce what's SRI, you know, volume two, or what's SRI plus the insetting that you're talking about, Ken, or whatever. I don't think of Cornell as like the rice mecca, so I'm curious how that came out of Cornell, but maybe that's a topic for another day, but my curiosity is making me ask.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because the person that introduced it to us is more of a social scientist and not from the ag side. Now, Cornell has a great ag school, But I would say Cornell is not a monolithic entity, right? They don't all think this way. And I think if you look at the funding that goes to a lot of these research institutions, a lot of times, I mean, I think the five largest food companies are five chemical companies. So I'm not going to say anything disparaging about Cornell, but it's not like everybody there believes in this either, because, you know, a lot of the research is in a different direction. This is something that, again, it's open source. Nobody owns this and nobody can make any money on it. I mean, we market it as something that's worthwhile, but we're doing it for a different reason. We don't.
But Dr. Norman Uphoff was the real person at Cornell behind SRI, and he traveled the world, with these smallholder farmers and really helping to make this more accessible. And again, through the NGO world, through Oxfam, through World Wildlife Fund. And, you know, what I love about all this is it's a true public sector, private sector partnership. It really is. And the collaboration, it's really the sum of the parts that really make it holistic. And, you know, rice is such an important crop. And in any village, rice is part of village life, from the planting to the harvesting to the cooking and eating. So it's not one entity. It really does. It's incredibly holistic. And that's the part that we like about it as well.
And Dr. Norman Uphoff, he himself, just like farmers, when they hear this, is skeptical. And so that's why he went out to kind of have conversations and found out that this is actually something that's going on. And the other skepticism was, you know, it was a Jesuit agronomist priest in the 80s that went to Madagascar to kind of help farmers to alleviate poverty, to have bigger yields. And through observation in the field, he saw that where the water broke away from the rice field, the plants were actually doing better that weren't underwater. So he kind of
observed things.
Yeah, so he was riffing on that and came up with this new way to grow rice. And that was in the 80s, and it really wasn't until the turn of the century that this got kind of traction. So what does that mean? That speaks to, I think, our unwillingness to change so fast, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somehow we need to get – it takes time, right? Just like anything. It takes a bit of time for people to grasp and then adopt.
Right. Well, we talk about time. You know, I think you mentioned you've been in business for 23 years now?
27 Six. Years.
27
years.
Let's go.
So that's extraordinary. So kudos to you for all the work you've done in the rice industry and bringing products to market and sharing this story with consumers to try to, you know, get more adoption towards these practices to scale more acreage. I'm curious, so like the future of Lotus, it's been 27 years. Like, what does the next 5 to 10 years look like? What are you trying to achieve? Is it new product innovations? Is it new category penetration? Is it about, you know, amount of acres you're transitioning to this new system? Talk a little bit about
above.
The future.
Yeah.
All of the above. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think our whole mission is to, if we have an audacious goal to change how rice is grown around the world, then we have a great foundation in these 26 plus years, but we have such a long way to go. And so, you know, one of our newest project is we're working with Jubilee Justice here in the U.S. for our 25th anniversary. We said we've got to do SRI in the U.S. And so now Conda Mason and Jubilee Justice is working with Black farmers in Louisiana and Mississippi and South Carolina and Georgia. And they're using SRI and they're totally loving it and seeing the benefits of it. And so right now they're experimenting with about 21 different varietals. And this is like their third year of experimentation. So there might be enough this year, but maybe by next year, there'll really be enough to really start marketing. But we're totally excited about that.
So our role is a market connector. So just, you know, a lot of times people think this SRI is something we thought up, but it's not. It's just that something that we think needs to be done. And so we support it. And sometimes, you know, we'll support farmers for their organic certification costs. Sometimes, you know, they may need some seed purification, or maybe they're looking for some type of way to create their own compost or, you know, green manure and stuff like that. So we try to help on in that regard. In the future, you know, we would love to build capacity on the ground and help farmers to actually own the means of production. So that means, like, for example, if they don't need to go to a privately owned mill and have their stuff milled, because when you do that, you don't get the byproducts. But the byproducts can be used on farm, could be to feed animals, could be to make, you know, mattresses or something like that. Or you could make, what is that called, Carol, when you burn the stuff?
Biochar.
Create more augmentation into the field, kind of give back to the soil. You know, there's all these things that farmers can do if they had more. And so that's I think that's where the future is too. How do we embed within those communities more of the means of production so that they can prosper? You know, like if we want to sell rice that's completely packaged and we don't have to clean it in the U.S. and package it, and if they could do it and meet our quality specifications, then that gives them even more income. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, we need to promote more win-win scenarios for the farmers themselves, because they're the ones who are really doing the good work.
Yeah. We really believe that we can lead the way in rice farming practices, in that also with these rice farming practices like regenerative, we can actually simultaneously not only mitigate climate, you know, change, but we can promote farmers' resilience, we can empower women, and we can give consumers alternative, healthier choices as well. So, you know, we're going to
be so exciting, you know,
it's extraordinary. Well, you know, when you think about it, there's a reason it's been around forever. Yeah. When you think about it, you can eat rice for breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, and dessert. Yeah. So you could have rice every day, all day.
Let's go.
and, you know, and rice also happens to be incredibly digestible. So it's not something like wheat that sits heavy in your belly. It really is incredibly, you know, digestible.
Which leads us to Rice is Life, which is our new cookbook coming out in October.
Hey, so we have a new cookbook called Rice is Life, and it is coming out in October. And the beautiful part of this cookbook is it has 65 incredible global recipes from around the world, but it really gets to tell our story. Mm-hmm. So it tells our founder's story and it tells the More Crop Per Drop story.
Love that's that. Really cool. I'll sign up for an early book. Absolutely. Yeah. Also, I make a ton of lotus rice with Kettle and Fire makes regenerative chicken broth, broth.
Yeah.
And so I make that and it's just like a nutrient powerhouse and I love it. Go. It's so satiating. And he's just making incredible stuff. So I'm excited for the book. I'm excited for the new products. It's going to be really cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm pumped that you guys are working with Jubilee Justice. They're an amazing organization. My man, Mark Watson in Potlicker Capital, I know works very tight with them. They're an amazing organization. We'll link their work below. They're just doing awesome stuff. So we'll let both of y'all answer our final question, which is really kind of our challenge to the space and the world at large. And the question is, how do we get regen brands to have 50% market share by 2050?
For me, again, it takes these partnerships. It takes everybody getting behind it. You know, the distributor, the retailer, the consumer, the brands. We can't do it alone. We all have to really pull. I mean, everybody has a role to play. And if everybody plays the role, and we can do it. And we have to do it. So I'm really excited to get everybody on board so that we can actually really have this impact that we all want and see and that we need.
Yeah. And I think kind of creating a dialogue where people can actually be heard, kind of, what we're doing now is a step, because I think you can hit people over the head with a doom and gloom story, but I don't think that's really catching, any momentum, to making positive change. But I think if people understood the good stories that are out there, that they feel like they could be part of that. Who wouldn't want to like help save the planet? Now, even from a standpoint of like big companies, like big CPG food companies, This is not a kind of a strange ask. This is not like a tree hugger issue, what we're talking about. This is like supply chain stability.
You know, right, and resiliency.
I mean, if we just, if the planet just incinerates or soil, topsoil is, is obliterated, then, you know, I don't think we're going to grow enough food for the planet on rooftops or in, you know, what is that?
We can't live off spring mix and tomatoes. I sold millions of dollars worth of spring mix and tomatoes, but we can't live off it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So I think, you know, just coming together and having an honest conversation and feeling like there's power within within our own, you know, within our own beings, and that we somehow can tap into that. So everybody's into like superpower movies and stuff, like, but but we all have that capacity, and once we realize it, that's how we can do it.
Yeah, awesome, I love that.
It's been you both have had an incredible energy and optimism and enthusiasm in our conversation today, and it's been really cool and fun to be a part of this. And really appreciate you two taking the time to, you know, sit down and chat regen with us, a couple of strangers on this call.
I learned so much. Wow.
I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah.
We did too. We love talking about it because rice is life.
Yep. Yep. Where can folks find more information on y'all?
I'd go into our new website, lotusfoods.com.
Love it.
And yeah, and just have fun with it. And
Cool. Well, congrats on everything. We're looking forward to the next conversation. Not in 27 years. We'll have one then as well, but maybe in a year or two, but we'll definitely be having them still in 27 years. So congrats on everything, y'all. Thanks for joining us.
That would be great.
Thanks so much for having us.
For show notes and more information on our guests and what we discuss on the show, check out our website, regen-brands.com. That is regen-brands.com. You can also check out our YouTube channel, Regen Brands Podcast, for all of our episodes with both video and audio. The best way to support our work is to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe to future episodes. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Regen Brands Podcast, brought to you by the Regen Coalition and Outlaw Ventures. We hope you learned something new in this episode, and it empowers you to use your voice, your time, and your dollars to help us build a better and more regenerative food system. Love you guys.